Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome. My name is Nigella Hilgarth. I'm the executive director here at the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. So welcome to the most recent Jeffrey B. Graham Perspectives on Ocean Science lecture. And it gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Stuart Standen. He is an assistant professor here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the Center of Marine Biodiversity and Conservation. He is originally from LA, and he did his BA here at UC San Diego, and then he did his PhD at Princeton in ecology and evolutionary biology. And then after another year as a postdoc at Princeton, he came here in 2004 to Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he's now an assistant professor. And his research today focuses mainly on community ecology, specifically investigating how organisms interact in complex marine communities. And he is lucky enough to do most of this research on fish communities on coral reefs in some of the most beautiful parts of the world, in the Caribbean and remote parts of the Pacific Ocean. And a lot of his work is focused on an archipelago called the Line Islands Archipelago. And I was lucky enough to briefly accompany one of their trips a year ago to a very remote part of the Line Islands, to a beautiful, pristine coral reef. And Stuart's research really focuses a lot on how we can learn a lot about coral reef ecology from these pristine reefs, and then working up the archipelago from how the impacts of humans on the inhabited islands. And I have to say I was enormously impressed by not only the beauty of the reefs, but the quality and intensity of the research that Scripps and his colleagues are doing on this subject. So without further ado, please help me welcome Stuart Standen to tonight's lecture, where he's going to talk about coral reefs and ecosystems in decline.
Thank you all for showing up. I appreciate the attendance here, and I look forward to telling you some stories about coral reefs. I want to begin with a caveat. I've titled the talk, Coral Reefs, Ecosystems in Decline, but I'm not going to tell you sob stories. I'm not going to spend the whole time telling you to worry about coral reefs because they're all going away. What I'm trying to communicate tonight is that there are things in coral reefs that give us some brighter views towards the future. So let's look towards that future. As we start looking towards the future, I want to start with a little bit of history just to give us some perspective into what's going on. I'll start with some history about myself. I did my PhD working on coral reefs of the Caribbean. I'd spent time working in the Florida Keys, Puerto Rico, a little island named Navassa, and I ultimately settled in the Southern Caribbean, in the islands of Curaçao and Bonaire. The reason I settled in that region was I thought that I had found perhaps the nicest coral reefs in the Caribbean. As I looked around, I would see corals like you see here with a abundant growth. They all seemed fairly healthy. The water was blue. The conditions were warm and tropical, and it was easy to get work done. But from my perspective, being someone who thinks more about things that move around than things that are stuck to the bottom, I apologize to those of you that are inherently in love with corals. I do love corals too, but fish swim. They have behavior. So I was really happy that there were lots of fish around as well. Here's me being happy. And what you'll see just below my hand there is some fish. These are fish that are doing what they do. They're feeding, they're reproducing, they're behaving. And so I was really excited to get this opportunity to study what was a coral reef that was intact, a coral reef that was a model of how a coral reef should work. My interest has always been in trying to communicate that science into effective management, into conservation action. And I've always had this leaning that we need to understand from a system that works in order for us to communicate and to try to improve our management of systems that maybe aren't quite as healthy. But then every dream goes away at some point. I was first exposed to the work of Jeremy Jackson, a professor recently retired from here at Scripps, who in 1997 published what I believe to be one of the more seminal papers in coral reef ecology. The paper was titled Reefs Since Columbus. It was a depiction of how coral reefs looked at the time of Western discovery of the Caribbean. Well, these stories had to look a lot like what I saw in Curacao, right? I'd found a great place to work. They were nicer than the Florida Keys. But then I read some of the quotations. He'd gone through history books, had looked at trip reports from explorers, searched far and wide to try to get a reconstruction of what coral reefs looked like in the middle of this millennium, actually last millennium. And the first they came to was the descriptions of the sea turtles, quotation looking like this. But in those 20 leagues, they saw very many more sea turtles, for the sea was thick with them, and they were of the very largest, so numerous that it seemed that the ships would run aground on them and were as if bathing in them. This is a depiction from southeast Cuba, from the second visit that Columbus made to the region. There are even reports from a little bit later on that ships sailing at night would be able to know that they were getting near land because they would start hearing sounds. They'd be hearing knocking on the hull of the ship. Those were the sea turtles foraging on the seagrass beds that surrounded the shallows of the islands. At that point, the captain would hold to, they'd wake up in the morning, and they'd be near an island. Well, in swimming around my pristine Caribbean coral reef, if I saw one sea turtle, I'd be excited. That's what I would talk about that evening with my friends, saying, well, I saw this, and I would describe its behavior. I did not crash into them as I was diving around the reefs of Curacao. Next came the stories of sea urchins. So sea urchins in some places are thought of as being a bane. They can cause problems. But in the Caribbean, well, what did it look like? On and about the coral reefs, the dreaded poisonous black sea egg, also known as Diadema antelarum, for those of you taxonomically focused, is common, and on certain areas it is so numerous that a person can scarcely move about without touching one. This is a depiction from Jamaica in 1919. In 1983, an epizootic, a disease, spread across the Caribbean and killed over 98% of all of this species of sea urchin from the entire basin. While I was doing my dissertation research, I wouldn't see Diadema, these sea urchins, or these sea eggs, in most of my dives. When I did see them, it would be in a couple key spots by channel entrances where we jump in the water to go diving and to come out. And unfortunately, I saw them penetrate the wetsuit of one of my dive buddies, and I got the very bad job of having to help him pull it out. But there are not very many sea urchins. Why would that matter? Sea urchins were perhaps the last ray of hope for a Caribbean in which the fish were gone. They're herbivorous, they eat algae. So in the competition for space between corals and algae, with these sea urchins gone, the algae won and corals lost. But from my perspective, these stories were okay. They were anomalies for me because I was thinking about fish. In fact, I was thinking about predators. Predatory coral reef fishes. Okay, here's a vicious video. I was studying the behavior of prey fish and the associated behavior of predators. How did predators respond to those schools of little fish that you see hopping around on this coral reef? Were they attracted to them? Were they repulsed from them? How did it affect the behavior of those little fish? Imagining being a little coral reef fish, the size of your pinky, floating around with a fish that could be 10, 100, or 1,000 times as heavy as you are. What would be what I would imagine it would be like to have been around during the Jurassic, being a little rodent trying to make its way with giant dinosaurs trying to eat you all the time. Yes, stress hormones would be going through the roof and you wouldn't be doing too well. You'd always be scattering, trying to stay alive. So I studied this and I studied it intensively. I was trying to watch how that guy could affect the behavior of the prey. I was thinking about the predators of the Caribbean. But then it dawned on me, reading Jeremy's paper and looking around, that a lot of the species that I knew should exist in the Caribbean, I wasn't seeing. Captain Jack Sparrow would have laughed at what he saw, as he's laughing here. Pirates were made to walk the plank when they did something wrong. This was in the Caribbean, and it was not like it is today. If you walk a plank in the Caribbean, you may do it at a resort like Sandals, and you do a cannonball. If you're really good, you do a backflip. And then you swim around and you grab a piña colada. Back in the day, if you walked the plank and you splashed into the water, you caused a ruckus. When you cause a ruckus, who comes visiting? Predators. Sharks. There were many sharks. Not just reef sharks, the smaller ones that get to be about as long as I am tall, but also tiger sharks, the ones that can cause problems. As you go further north, bull sharks. These are the two of these sharks, the ones that people are afraid of today. And what were they eating? Remember the banging on the hull of the ship? Those sea turtles? That was their lunch, dinner, and frequently breakfast. Yeah, they would affect the other fish around, but there were a lot of teeth around. There were a lot of big animals living a very complex life. There were real predators. Today, the predators look different. Today, the predators have two legs and two arms. Today, the predators are us. We fish in this region. This is a group of Haitians I met when I was diving off the island of Navassa, which has conflicted ownership between the United States and Haiti. And you can see that they're pulling fish out, trying to make a living. These people would sail their way over from Haiti to this little island. It's about 100 miles away, with a tiny outboard motor that they would try to save gasoline. They were trying to make a living. Small-scale fisheries, artisanal fisheries, are our predators today, as they've been for centuries past. And we can see evidence of this, specifically from the Caribbean. If we look to the more recent history, as opposed to simply thinking about what did the history books describe, which can always be prone to exaggeration, we can look to photographs. So on the left, you'll see a work from one of our recent graduates at Scripps, Lauren McClanahan. She described the recreational fishing patterns, the catch from recreational fishing boats from the Florida Keys, in particular Key West. It was comparing catch described from photographs in the 1950s, the 1980s, it's a second panel down, you see color emerge, and then more recently, the late 2000s. And what do you see? Big fish, smaller fish, smaller fish. Similarly, we look on the right, and these are photographs from two groups of spear fishermen in the island of Curacao. So on the top, this is one of the contacts that Ayanna Johnson, also a recent graduate of Scripps, talked to, worked a lot with in understanding how the artisanal fishery there works. Jose used to go fishing as a kid, would go spear fishing, and this was 1 hour's worth of a dive. Those are big groupers, the size of which I do not see on Curacao today. On the bottom, that's the catch in 2009. Mind you, spear fishing is illegal on Curacao, but we got a clandestine photograph of a bin filled with two divers' day's worth of work. If you were to weigh the bin on the top, or the pole on the top and the bin on the bottom, I bet you the 1 hour's work is paying off better rewards. So things are changing, and the predators have shifted up a trophic level. We are now the predators, the top predators, and we've changed the way that these ecosystems work. So as we try to manage the fisheries, as we try to manage the coral reef for growth, we want corals to be around, we have to take into perspective how the systems changed. arguably, we want to get back some of those characteristics from the past. From the photographs that are in black and white here, to the depictions from Columbus's group. But how are we going to learn about this? If I was studying the quote-unquote best coral reefs of the Caribbean, how do we learn what a coral reef can look like and how it can work? Well, we have to go somewhere else. Ironically, coral reefs hold some of the most pristine, intact marine ecosystems left on the planet. If you think about the geography of the planet, most of the ocean is around the tropics in warm water. Think about the equator. The planet's the biggest around the equator. Think of the Pacific Ocean. That's a lot of big blue expanse. And in the middle of that, on the equator, are a number of islands that have coral reefs on them. And it turns out that these areas are home to some of the most intact, visually stunning, and ecologically valuable coral reefs left on the planet. That's where we've been working. And that's what brought me here. 2004, I showed up to help lead an expedition to the Central Pacific, to the Line Islands archipelago. What was important about this region was two characteristics. First, there were islands here that, due to their remoteness, had never been affected by people, had no local fishing activity, no local inhabitants. But secondly, there were neighboring islands right next door that had people living on them. We both could study what a coral reef can look like, and we can study how that community structure changes with people. In this case, mainly fishing activity. This was the first of our expeditions to the region. Our vessels have gotten nicer. This vessel, the White Holly, fairly rusty. Another lesson in history. It was christened on D-Day, but it kept us alive, albeit with a few topical infections that spread throughout the entire crew. Okay, so I told you that there's some uninhabited islands and some inhabited islands. Let's do a quick geography lesson. Two of the islands here are part of the United States, Kingman Reef and Palmyra. Kingman is uninhabited, has hardly any emergent land, has never been, because it has no land, is just an atoll, provides good anchorage, but has never had a local population. Palmyra similarly has never maintained a long-term population. It had a short-term population during World War II when the U.S. Navy stationed about 5,000 men on the island. After World War II, the men were removed, the barracks were removed, and it went back to nature. We then go a little bit further south, closer to the equator, and we have two islands that are inhabited, part of the Republic of Kiribati. You see it's spelled there, K-I-R-I-B-A-T-I. I'm not just lisping. It is pronounced Kiribati, so the T-I is pronounced as an S in the Kiribati language. They weren't given the letter S by the missionaries that showed up and brought written language, so just run with this when you see T-I, try an S. Tabuaran, also known as Fanning, had a population of about 2,500 people. No runway, the only access is by boat, which is ephemeral and itinerant, and most of the protein comes from the sea. You go to Christmas Island. That has more people. 5,000 was the official estimate in 2005, probably closer to 10,000 people. Also living off of the marine resources, fishing out of the lagoon, and then the reef, and then the nearshore environment. A little bit of industry here, the industry being growing coconuts, literally, for copra. And this is for coconut meat that they make oil out of, coconut oil. So the population there does not have industry, aside from fishing, artisanal fishing, and raising coconut. They're not polluting. There's no golf courses. There's hardly any water there. And they're fishing directly from the ocean. What we have here is an experiment. Similar types of coral reef environments, some that have been fished and some that haven't. So what did we find? Well, we jumped in the water. We brought experts studying everything from fish to corals to seaweed to down to bacteria and viruses. We studied everything that we could find. I'll focus mainly on the fish. I said that the major impact was fishing. And if you look at the graph at the top, the islands now are organized from, the least inhabited to the most inhabited. I should point out Palmyra has a population of about 20 people. We're founding members of a field station that operates on the island, and those 20 people are our field station staff. They are not fishing. But what do we find? As we go from uninhabited to inhabited, there are less fish. As you go from unfished to fished, there are fewer fish. For this, I'm expecting a call from Stockholm, because I think there is a Nobel Prize somewhere in here. More fishing, less fish. But it's not only the trend that's impressive, but there are two things that are quantitatively important. First off is the simple magnitude of decline. We're seeing about a 60-70% reduction in the total fish biomass. Let me give you a quick primer for marine biology. We don't pick up all the fish and weigh them to estimate how much they weigh. We swim down set transects of a width and a length, and we know how big that area is, and we count every fish that's there. We identify it to species, we identify it to length, and we count how many there are. Fish grow really regularly, which is nice. So if you tell me the length of a fish and the species, I can give you a good approximation of how much it weighs. So from these counts, and many of them, we're able to give these estimates of biomass. Okay, so we get less fish biomass. But also impressive is thinking about how the composition shifts. I've stacked these bars in terms of trophic level being where you eat on the food chain. Higher up on the bar is higher on the food chain, lower on the bar is lower in the food chain. The black, in this case, are the top predators. These are the fish that eat other fish. And what do you see? As we fish more, those predators are the ones that disproportionately are declined. On Kingman and Palmyra, over half of the biomass is made up of the predators. On Tabuaran and Christmas, you have a lot less than half. About 20-25% of the biomass are these predators. Okay, let's put that first number into context. How much fish biomass are we talking about? Well, we're not starting from scratch. People have counted fish before in other locations, so we can give some comparisons. Let's go to some of the best places on the planet. The northwestern Hawaiian Islands, Papahanaumokuakea, the national monument that President Bush put into effect in 2006, protected because it had a lot of fish. Well, those islands support a biomass of about 250 grams per meter squared. Kingman had 500. Okay, let's put this into context. Meter squared, about a square yard. And in that square meter is about 1 pound of fish. And for every square meter across the entire reef, there's a pound of fish. That's a lot of fish. We're only talking about a half pound in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Go to the Great Barrier Reef, one of the world's monuments. We find that the best spot there rivals the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, which is less than what we saw in Kingman and Palmyra. We start going to my beloved Curacao and Bonaire. We're talking about a quarter of the biomass. And then we go to the places that are common, that we commonly visit on vacation. The main Hawaiian Islands, Fiji, Jamaica. Got that piña colada back in our hands. And we go snorkeling. We do our cannonball off of our pirate ship. And what do we find? Less than 100, getting close to 50 grams per meter squared, about 1/10 the total biomass. Okay, yes, fishing reduces the amount of fish that's there, but that reduction is dramatic. As we lose our fish and we change the structure, there are associated changes of the benthic environment, what's living on the bottom, the corals, the seaweed, and such. Here's a photographic of what's going on. We start from the top, that's Kingman, down to Palmyra, Tabuaran, and Christmas going down. On the left is a common picture of what you may see in up in the water column, going from lots of big fish, clear blue water, through to there being small fish, and the water starts getting murky. On the right panels there, we have what the bottom looks like. Common photographs. Put a quadrat down and take a photograph. We go from a system that's growing lots of corals, and where there's not coral, you see that pink stuff. The pink stuff is a type of seaweed. It's called crustose coralline algae, and it holds the reef together. It actually builds the coral reef as well. We get less coral and less of that crustose coralline algae, less of the reef builders as we get fewer fish. There are these associated changes that work in a correlated way. Our goal is to try to understand how this is happening and then try to think of ways that maybe we could reverse this pattern. But first, I had to address an issue. That issue is called colleagues who thought that I was perhaps an idiot for not knowing how to count fish, said those numbers were really high, did not believe that you could actually have that many fish on a coral reef. Those numbers were the highest that had ever been recorded on a coral reef. So we took our show on the road. As if we weren't already somewhere very remote, we started visiting other parts of the Central Pacific. Let me just put this into context. This map right now, you can see the inset. That's half of the planet, that little black and white inset. We're looking at about half of that half of the planet. So it's about a quarter of the surface of the planet, maybe a fifth or a sixth, a lot. And we started visiting a lot of these regions. We've gone a little bit broader than this. We started with our visit to the Northern Line Islands. We've subsequently visited that island, Palmyra, a number of times on this little G1 aircraft. We visited Kingman Reef, which is just north of Palmyra, 2007. 2009, we visited the Southern Line Islands, five uninhabited islands south of the equator. 2009, also visited some of the Phoenix Islands, also uninhabited islands. And then just recently, as you'll see on the display on the wall, we went back to the Northern Line Islands in fall 2010. And what did we find? Let's focus on the fish. Well, those bars stay fairly high. The data on the left you saw before, those are Kingman Palmyra on the far left. Now we go to the Southern Line Islands in the middle and the Phoenix Islands on the right. The bars are consistently high, with some exceptions we'll get to. And the dark part, the predators, are consistently a large fraction. There are a lot of fish when you don't fish. Coral reefs can support a lot of fish biomass. And it's not just because we study one location. Here we're looking at different depths. Most of the work we did was at 10 meters depth, 30 feet. If we go shallower, we go deeper. There's a lot of fish on Kingman here. This is an aerial photograph of Kingman. There's a lot of fish biomass and there's a lot of predators. Go to different types of reef. Fore reef, back reef, patch reefs. Consistently lots of fish biomass and lots of predators. The story is consistent. We can go even more broadly geographically by working with some federal colleagues. NOAA's Coral Reef Ecosystem Division, based in Honolulu, visits 40 to 50 U.S. protectorates across the tropical U.S. waters every other year, with budget cuts maybe every third year. And they count the fish that are there, and they count characteristics of the benthic environment, the oceanography, etc. We have a very nice snapshot of what these coral reefs look like, including the uninhabited ones. Lo and behold, areas further from where people live have more fish. And also in these little pies, the size of the pie is telling you the amount of fish biomass. The segment of it that's black is telling you the fraction that's top predators. The red stars are telling you where the people live, so we can look in the main Hawaiian Islands. You recognize Oahu and the inhabited main Hawaiian Islands. Go to the northwestern, lots more fish, lots more predators. If we go to the Mariana Archipelago, people live in the southern islands, they don't live in the northern islands. The circles get bigger to the north. If we go to American Samoa, you see that near the population core in Tutuila, as you go outside to Rose and Swains, the circles get bigger and there are more predators. And then there are the remote islands. These are the uninhabited islands that are scattered across the Pacific. And they're consistently large and predator rich. I want to take a quick aside to say, hey, this is a pretty neat part of the planet. There's some special places here that are worthy of protection. Fortunately, I'm not the only one to think that's true, but President Bush and Laura Bush in particular thought that was true as well. During his tenure as president, and especially in his last month in office in 2009, he created three additional monuments, President Bush did. The Pacific Remote Islands Monument, that includes Palmyra and Kingman. The Marianas Trench Marine National Monument, that covers those northern Mariana Islands, and then the Rose Atoll Marine National Monument down the south. So these areas now are protected in perpetuity by the U.S. government. This is about 100 years after Teddy Roosevelt started the National Park System and other land-based protection measures. We have now a network of marine protected areas in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that protect some of the most pristine marine habitats left on the planet. And for this, we should be happy. And for this, we should be thinking about ways that we actually enforce this protection, because you can imagine it's difficult to enforce protection in the middle of the Pacific. But we're a step closer. So to complement some of these historical accounts that we were given from the Caribbean, Jeremy and one of his students went through the history books to start learning about the Central Pacific. A question came up, the inhabited Christmas Island. We did not see a shark during the dives or on our transects during that first expedition. And the question was raised, did the sharks ever live there? Well, the accounts look similar to the accounts that we saw from the history books in the Caribbean. On every side of us swam sharks innumerable and so voracious that they bit our oars and rudder. And I actually struck my hanger 2 inches into the back of one whilst he had the rudder between his teeth. It's a depiction from the late 1700s in the lagoon of Christmas Island. So we're able to see plenty of sharks in these regions, and people have been the agent of change. Okay. But we're not only talking about sharks in this case. I've been using the term top predators. These are fish that eat other fish. We're talking about fish like this, the two-spot red snapper. This photo's thanks to Professor Jennifer Smith, also here at Scripps. This one we call the vampire snapper. He would bite us every once in a while, but more love bites. Little nibbles on the ear. This guy seems to have gotten himself in a little bit of trouble missing a tooth. But also schools of fish like these jacks or trevally. These are the fish that do serve as a good food resource for a lot of people, including my friend Tuake here, who's one of the fisheries officers of the Republic of Kiribati. He lives on Tarawa. And when we were diving in the Phoenix Islands, he saw this school of fish and got so excited he had to tell his family. He pulled on me, I was in the middle of counting fish, and said, "Take a photo of me, I have to send this to my kids." I want to point out that I think that the Ekiribus are some of the best divers on the planet because they can dive in jean shorts and polo shirts and come out and be dry in about 5 minutes. It's phenomenal. But we're talking about fish. These fish are fish that we care about, both in terms of their role as predators and their role as food. So there are reasons for us to be thinking about them, both in terms of the ecosystem services that they offer and the direct resources they offer to keep Tuake and his family and keep all of us fed. So let's go back to this graph. We're back to thinking about these islands. I said most were uninhabited, and I said that there was some variation we should think a little bit about. We've got consistently high predator biomass, lots of predators in these systems, but some where we don't, we see less. So I want to point out the ones that are a bit lower in the Line Islands, or the Northern Line Islands, are the ones that were inhabited. That's where we've been very good at getting rid of a lot of the predators. And the Phoenix Islands, three of the islands, before it was made as well into a protected area, after the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands were protected, the Phoenix Islands protected area was made. Just before that designation, a permit was sold to fin three of the islands, Canton, Arona, and Phoenix, or Rewaukee. That license was sold for $5,000. I would have given $6,000 at least. The permit allowed a fishing boat to come in and long line all of the reef sharks that lived around this island. They came in, they spent about a month fishing each of the islands, and they pulled out most of the reef sharks. So the fish assemblage has changed because of intensive fishing. It shows just how fragile these areas are if we don't take some earnest protection. The good part of this is that these are uninhabited islands, and fish do like to reproduce. And while I was in the Phoenix Islands in 2009, I saw schools of little gray reef sharks. They aggregate in schools when they're juveniles to protect themselves. They were about 2 feet long and scuttling all over the reef. So it looks like there's a capacity for this system to rebuild. Okay, but let's think a little bit more about what predators are doing on coral reefs and how they can even be there. I want to turn the data on their head, as it were, and make a little pyramid out of them. I said that two of the islands had more predators than prey. Now, those of you that who have taken introductory ecology are probably a little surprised. We learned that there should be trophic pyramids, fewer predators than prey, but I'm showing it in reverse. What's going on here? Well, this is where I was beating my head against the wall. I knew it was theoretically possible, but was just really trying to find a way to grasp it. And I was in a great segment that the New York Times has, the Scientists at Work blog. I had written something about it, and somebody wrote back and gave me the answer. It's really quite simple, PubWVJ from Vermont tells me. Prey grows fast. Predators conserve biomass. Mass accumulates at the predator end of the scale. Don't be prey. Eat more meat. The anti-vegetarian sentiment aside, the point is well taken. What's happening is that those predators are old, those predators are big, and those predators don't need to eat very much to stay alive. In contrast, the prey, the smaller fish, grow quickly. Those prey are eaten quickly, and those prey, on average, are young. There's high turnover at the bottom of the food chain and high longevity at the top of the food chain. It's like mowing your lawn rapidly. You always end up with more mulch than you do by harvesting it continuously. It grows quickly. Think of those prey fish as being a rapidly growing lawn that's being mowed by the predators. But we can think about, and at least in general terms, why it even matters to have these predators. Why should we care? It's cool. For diving industries, you can get maybe a bit more money if you have some big fish around. But let's think about some of their ecological roles. Well, the first thing, most straightforward thing about predators is that if you remove them, you reduce the amount of predation. There are pretty dramatic differences in the amount of predation. This fish on the right there was a fish that we pulled in during a study of the growth patterns. We were actually trying to work out how old this red snapper is. You pull them in, they've got these neat stones in their head, bones in their head called otoliths. You can cut them in half. And if you take a cross section, they look like tree rings. You count how many years old the fish is. We're pulling this fish in as fast as we could. Does that look familiar to anybody? That's a shark bite. If you don't pull fast enough, the shark eats the fish before you get it on the boat. So predators cause predation, and it's a lot different than my little video from the Caribbean. But they don't just eat anybody. They'll try to eat anybody. They don't try to eat us. You don't have to worry about our livelihood. We'll stay alive. But they eat, in particular, some of the smaller ones, the weaker ones, the less well-defended fish on the reef. This is what we think of as survival of the fittest. It's a reason that fish, when predators are around, tend to be big, because the little ones get cropped off quickly. And the ones that can survive and can survive for a long enough time to reproduce are the ones that make it through the gauntlet of predation. Being small, they want to grow really quickly to get big enough so that they don't fit in as many predators' jaws anymore. So we can think about this and think about how that structures a food web. It's going to make for not only the predators being big, but the prey to be made up of larger bodied individuals. Now, why is that going to matter? Well, we know the basic allometry, the scaling of fish. Big fish make more fish. If you imagine that your spawning biomass is about the same, but it's made up of one large individual or a lot of small individuals, what's going to be the total number of eggs that are produced, the total number of babies? It's going to be a lot more from the big individual. There's this reproductive benefit to being large-bodied and being fish. And so if you have more fish that are bigger bodied, you get a lot more reproductive output. That means more productivity for the next generation, for you to fish again, for you to fish again. And finally, and perhaps less straightforwardly, predators shift the basic ecology of ecosystems. If you have jaws following you around all the time, you're going to behave differently. If there are jaws successfully eating fish, you're going to end up with a different group of fish left. And the cascading effects of this pattern of predation are profound. And we're only starting to work it out. And that's true across all ecosystems. What are some basic things we can summarize? Well, it appears that when predators are removed, at least too many predators are removed, you reduce the productivity of the fishery. You change what species are there, you change their growth rates in ways that lead to us being able to harvest less. Granted, this is at extreme levels of fishing. Well, predators also help to stabilize fisheries. If you imagine that you have fluctuations, you get a great big recruitment pulse, a lot of new babies show up, predators can help to stabilize that. They can help to make that big boom of fish not oscillate for time undetermined. We've shown that offshore here in the local fisheries. But there's also this last one, the elephant in the room, climate change. We can talk our whole lives about fishing, but the planet is changing underneath us and around us. And coral reefs are no exception. It appears that predators have a direct role in changing the way that ecosystems respond to climate change. Okay, well, there's some great case studies. Think about the wolf reintroduction to Yellowstone. There have been really neat stories that have gone to try to connect the dots. It was shown that once the wolves came back, we started getting recruitment. New aspen trees started to grow up in river areas where they hadn't grown for years before. How did that happen? Well, it turned out when the wolves weren't there, that their prey, the elk, happily were eating all the aspen babies. They could feed wherever they wanted, and the river was a great place because there was no predators around. You put a predator in the mix, wolves, and the elk no longer spend time in the river areas. They're too exposed. And the aspen were able to start regenerating. You watch the whole ecosystem start to shift in response to the predators being reintroduced. Started working in a way that, you know, a lot of us would be happy to imagine. We see that near shore here in the kelp environments. This is a poster you may have seen before, but where Paul Dayton has tried to depict his story of the ghosts of the kelp forest. Yes, all of these species live in a kelp forest, but not all of them are highly abundant anymore. And in fact, some are ecologically extinct. There's so few of them that they aren't serving their role anymore. How does this change what's going on? Well, some of our recovery potential, say abalone, may be retarded from regrowing, even though you may have abalone babies, and we can outplant baby abalone, but they aren't showing up. Why? Probably because the moray eel's gone, who used to control densities of octopus. Octopus are eating all the abalone baby. How exactly each of these things works? It's a topic for debate, but there are not functionally that many morays, and there are a lot of octopus nowadays. But there's also some linkages between us removing some of these predators and the response of the kelp forest itself. We see more of a likelihood for kelp forest to die off during hot water events, the El Nino events, because of a transition to so-called urchin barrens. Sea urchin densities boom. They then eat away all the kelp. More pointedly, they eat away the base of the kelp stalks that they hold fast, and the plants float away. When there are too many sea urchins, the kelp density can get grazed down, making these urchin barrens. What used to prevent that? Well, these things like sheephead. Predators used to be able to eat those sea urchins and prevent their densities from booming during events when the climate's changing the water temperature and changing the entire balance and growth patterns of the constituent species. There are these apparent links between some overarching activities or behaviors of ecosystems, climate change, and predators. Well, let's try to connect the dots here. Let's try to connect the dots between predators, prey, and coral reef resilience. Okay, what do I mean by resilience? Well, the same thing that you mean by resilience when you talk about a person or somebody in terms of their health. It's the capacity of a system to rebound after it's affected by something. Okay, let's imagine that you have a coral here and a hot water event shows up. What may you expect to see? You may expect to find that coral dying. In hot water, the tissue could die. You have something called coral bleaching. The physiology of the coral, actually the symbiosis in the coral, gets jarred, and the coral tissue may die. The coral tissue may, that area that used to be made up of coral, can transition over to being seaweed. But in some cases, you can have those corals regrowing. You get little guys showing up, they land on that skeleton where the other coral used to live, and they start growing. And if everything goes really well, the whole system bounces back and you end up at where you started. Not exactly where you started, it's a different colony, but certainly you've got the same amount of coral around. The system was able to bounce back. Now we're finding that in many places of the planet, this capacity to bounce back, this resilience, is being lost in so-called ratchets. As you have one warm water event, some corals die, the corals may start to regrow, but before they can regrow enough to reach their historic levels, they get hit by another impact and another. And what you see is the things that we want on a coral reef, like corals, things that are building the coral reef, become more and more sparse. That would be the ratchet. But it appears that in these remote areas of the Pacific, they are able to regrow. Let's take a case study here. Let's just look right now at a series of photo quadrats from Palmyra Atoll. These are taken by Jen Smith. We're spanning just over a year in terms of time here. You start time point one. Time point two, you see the corals grow, and then maybe you see some die, but you see general growth. These are those slimy rocks on coral reefs. They grow really rapidly. They have a capacity to take over space. There is this ability for a coral reef to be resilient. But is there evidence that it actually happens at an ecosystem scale? Let's take a case study. The immovable object meets the unstoppable force. I wanted drama. I had to make up for Jack Sparrow. The Phoenix Islands protected area. The Republic of Kiribati took their 8 islands that were all uninhabited, minus a little group of people protecting the area, and they made them into the biggest marine protected area in the Pacific, bigger than Bush's monuments. This area was home to some of the most pristine coral reefs on the planet. Still is unfished. But in 2002 and 2003, reefs that look like this, that were our immovable object, got hit by this. A hot water event that lasted for the greater part of a year. A massive El Nino that was bathing the reefs of the Phoenix Islands, the square in the middle there, with waters that were a few degrees above the typical high, 2 to 3 degrees higher than that, for the greater part of a year. That's a lot of stress. That'd be like you being put in a jacuzzi and left there for a year. You probably wouldn't look too good either. But these coral reefs did not fare very well. Some of the islands actually lost upwards of 90% of all their coral through bleaching and subsequent mortality. Some of the islands had less, 50, but there was a tremendous amount of loss. Let's look at data here. This is David Obura here in this photograph, inspecting a new coral showing up. We've got 3 time points. This area is very hard to get to, so we don't have that much data. 2002, before the bleaching event. Let's look at the top panel there. That's the coral. We see a big drop on average. What we see in the subsequent years, that's 2005 in the middle, as we go to 2009, we start moving up. We've about doubled, or at least half again increased, the amount of coral that's there. Across this entire archipelago, we're watching the corals that had been devastated regrowing, and regrowing at an ecosystem scale at a rate that's unprecedented. If you imagine that trend continuing, we have hope to actually get the corals back to some semblance of what they look like within a decade. Corals have been around for millions of years, and they grow at geologic scales in some cases, at least to our eyes. But it turns out that if given a chance, if allowed a little bit of a reprieve from some of our local stressors, these things have this capacity to bounce back, so-called resilience. Well, in this picture of David, we see some of the key players. Where's Waldo? Right there. Fish. It all comes back to fish, at least in my eyes. If we think about this region and we look at some of the data that we have, there are massive assemblages of fish, and in particular, large fish, and in particular, large herbivorous fish, the ones that eat seaweed. What's happening? Well, even in the islands where we had 90% of all the coral lost, where the bulk of the bottom was made up of soft algae because it was freed space, and what can grow quickly? Seaweed. All that seaweed was controlled. It was kept at bay by a series of lawnmowers. Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of lawnmowers, each weighing a few pounds. These parrotfish, each are about 50 centimeters long. They're big fish. They had this capacity to keep all that seaweed from overgrowing and outcompeting the corals, and gave the corals a chance to regrow. So the key question that we have is, how do we keep benefiting from the ocean? And when I say benefiting, I mean not only keeping the fish showing up, keeping our fisheries productivity high, but also keeping the corals themselves growing, keeping the habitat growing, keeping the shorelines protected while not destroying it. Okay, this is a balancing act. If we think through the problem, we cannot maintain a world full of islands like Kingman. We cannot maintain a world made up of islands like those Southern Line Islands. These unfished, predator-heavy systems with fish that live to be 50 years old. We can't have that globally. We're pushing 7 billion people on the planet. In the tropics, we have hundreds of millions of people living within a few miles of shore, within a few miles of coral reefs. And you know where those people in the tropics, those hundreds of millions of people living near shore in the tropics, are getting their food? They're getting over 25% of their protein from coral reefs. So that means that these coral reefs have to be a source of protein. Otherwise, we're going to see a number of people dying. I'm not a fan of that. But we also want to keep those coral reefs growing. The fish aren't going to grow if we fish too many fish out, and then all the reefs become seaweed reefs. There's going to be no shelter. There's going to be nowhere for those fish that are hiding from the giant dinosaurs trying to eat them all the time. There's going to be nowhere for them to hide. There's a balancing act between protection and use. It turns out that most of the world's coral reefs, we've passed that threshold, that optimization, if you will, between protection and use. But by studying these remote areas, we're actually starting to get a glimpse. We're going over the hump, as it were. We know that a system that has no fish and dead coral reefs isn't giving us what we want. We also know that these protected areas are really nice for the sake of heritage, but aren't giving us any food. We can't fish them. They're protected. So somewhere in between, we're going to get the most fish out of it. Somewhere in between, we're going to get the corals growing. Somewhere in between, we're going to find this balance between fisheries productivity and coral growth. I'd argue that we're going to find it in some of these remote islands of the Pacific. And to find it, we have to find out what ecological principles are of most importance. We've already identified that one of the most important characteristics is the maintenance of those herbivorous fish. In this photograph, those little striped things there, convict sturgeon fish. If you've been to Hawaii, you might know them as manini, because they're small. These are actually big relative to the manini you'd see in Hawaii. These are all herbivorous fish. You can easily come across schools of thousands of these fish keeping all the seaweed at bay, allowing corals a chance to grow. Well, I can imagine a world where we take, say, 20% of these fish. They may grow to be 10 years old, but if we give the population a chance to rebound, we harvest, let them rebound, harvest, let them rebound, we can keep their activities while maintaining our fisheries productivity. It's finding that balance that's going to be key in coral reefs, and it's going to be finding that balance that's going to be key in our nearshore waters. So I want to leave you with one last quotation. We're getting, our history is getting more and more current. And I refer back to Aldo Leopold. A land ethic, then, reflects the existence of an ecological conscience, and this in turn reflects a conviction of individual responsibility for the health of the land. You can replace ocean. Health is the capacity for the land for self-renewal. Conservation is our effort to understand and preserve this capacity. And I align with this perspective. We're not worried about just cordoning off the world, saying this area is conserved and that area is not. We actually have to find a way to make a balance. We have to allow the ecosystems to maintain their capacity for self-renewal. I talked about that as resilience earlier. It's finding that balancing point that's the hard part. And it's finding that balancing point that we have the discipline of ecology to help us out, and we have our federal and academic colleagues to help be studying this. But I just want to point out before ending, I invite you to take a closer look at Aldo Leopold here. Thought of as a conservationist, there to protect what's out there, and what's on his back? Arrows. We need to use the land. We are not independent of it. We're part of the ecosystem. I pointed out before that we are today's predators in every ecosystem. But the one thing that we have differently, that we have different than the sharks on coral reefs, is the capacity to think a little bit longer into the future. We have a capacity to hunt with a conscience. We have a capacity to plan what we take and to design it both spatially and also to design laws and regulations to harvest in ways that are likely to give us benefits in the long term. Through research and then through effective communication and management schemes, we have a capacity to do that and to support the people living on the planet. With that, I want to thank you for your attention and I welcome any questions. First off, I kind of want to spend a little bit of time on that term regulation, with saying that wolves regulate their populations. What's happening with the wolves is that if they have enough food, they'll reproduce, and if they don't, they won't. And that's straightforward. And that happens with most every species. They'll reproduce when given enough food. And it's true with fish as well. So what we see with fish is that they've got a little bit more flexibility than with land mammals. Mammals have to invest a set amount of energy to raise each pup. And actually, it's a lot. For fish, they just spawn. But what we do find is that a better fed fish is going to invest more in reproductive output, and a less well-fed fish is going to invest less. So it's likely that we're going to see this type of regulation through food, competition for food. When there's less food, they're going to reproduce less. Ironically, we have very little information about that from the sea, because there are very few places that there are enough predators that are actually out there competing with one another for food. That's one of the key areas of research that my lab's working on, is trying to explore what happens when predators compete, where they aren't all feeding ad lib. And it's actually a pretty ripe area for research.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.